aging is something we all do, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. And I just think we elders have so much to learn and to benefit by learning from that example. Maybe we won't make it all the way to pride and to embracing, but to accepting it and acknowledging it and seeing that we are who we are because we're the age we are, just as because we're the color we are, the gender we are, not despite it.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome. This episode of the At Home On Air podcast is an archived conversation from May of 2020. In honor of Disability Pride Month, we're bringing you this engaging conversation. Moving toward pride, what an anti-ageism movement can learn from disability pride. Your hosts for this conversation are Susie Stadler, an architect and the executive director of At Home with Growing Older, the producer of this podcast, and Sarah Ingram, who is a disability activist and former team member of At Home with Growing Older. Our guest speakers are two amazing women, each a thought leader and movement builder, one in anti-ageism, the other in the disability pride movement. Ashton Applewhite is a writer and the author of This Chair Rocks, a manifesto against ageism. She's been recognized by the New York Times, NPR, The New Yorker, and the American Society on Aging as an expert on ageism. She has written for Harper's, among other publications. Ashton blogs at thischairrocks.com and is the founder of the Old School Anti-Ageism Clearinghouse. She is also the author of Cutting Loose, Why Women Who End Their Marriages Do So Well. In 2022, the United Nations named Ashton one of the Healthy Aging 50. 50 leaders transforming the world to be a better place to grow older. Our second guest speaker is Tiffany Yu, who is a social impact entrepreneur, diversity and inclusion community builder, and disability advocate. She is the CEO and founder of Diversability, an award-winning social enterprise to rebrand disability. She founded the Awesome Foundation Disability Chapter, a monthly microgrant for disability projects. Tiffany is a 3-times TEDx speaker, and her TED Talk, How to Help Employees with Disabilities Thrive, has over 1 million views. She is also the author of The Anti-Ableist Manifesto, Smashing Stereotypes, Forging Change, and Building a Disability-Inclusive World. And in 2025, she was named on the Forbes Accessibility 100 list. Before we jump into the conversation, let me share some key concepts that will help frame what you're about to hear. There are 2 main ways people think about disability. The first is what's called the medical model. It sees disability as something that needs to be fixed or cured. The second is the social model. It says that the real problem isn't the person, it's how society is set up. Think of it this way. It's the stairs that are the problem, not the wheelchair user. So we're really talking about whether disability is something wrong with a person or whether it's just another way of being human. You'll also hear 3 different approaches to disability advocacy. Disability rights focuses on laws and legal protections. Disability justice looks at how disability intersects with other forms of discrimination. And disability pride is about celebrating disability as part of human identity. Now, while anti-ageism and disability pride are different movements, there's a lot they can learn from each other. In this conversation, we'll explore how these movements might work together to find common ground beyond just physical abilities. The COVID-19 pandemic really highlighted this connection. Suddenly, older adults and people with disabilities were grouped together as vulnerable populations. This moment showed us how these communities face similar challenges and stereotypes. So the question becomes, what can an anti-ageism movement learn from disability pride? Tiffany, as part of Diversibility, we're interested in the question you ask your guests. What's their disability story? What brought you to start asking this question, and what's your disability story?
I have two disability origin stories. A lot of this is adapted from an Emory professor named Rose Marie Garland Thompson. If you want to learn more about her, she wrote a piece for the New York Times disability opinion section called Becoming Disabled. And the reason why I love asking this question is because all of our disability origin stories are different. If you just look at what the physical manifestation is of my disability, you won't really know the whole context and the cultural lens through which I grew up, which has impacted a lot of how I grew up viewing disability. The reason why I say I have two disability origin stories is because my first disability origin story is when I became disabled. And my second disability origin story is when I became proud of my disability identity. The first, and I will give you the Cliff Notes version of this, I do have a TED Talk that goes way into detail of that first disability origin story, but mine happened when I was 9. Thanksgiving weekend, the day after my dad's birthday, we dropped my mom off at the airport for a business trip, and on the way home, he lost control of the car. Single vehicle car accident. He unfortunately passed away. I have a spinal cord injury called a brachial plexus injury, which has paralyzed my right arm. In my context, where I actually think most of the trauma happened was in post-car accident recovery. So I was in the hospital for 3 weeks. Due to a lot of Asian cultural values, we don't really talk about death, we don't really talk about disability, and we definitely don't talk about mental health. And so all of those really colored the experience through which I moved throughout the world for the next 10 years. I never told anyone about my arm or the car accident or my dad. And why that made sense is because the car accident happened in elementary school. Same kids from elementary school to middle school to high school, so I never really had to explain myself. The disability pride origin story started about 10 years ago. So the car accident happened in 97. Honestly, from the period between 1997 until 2009, I'm not really sure I remember anything. I kind of felt like I was just floating along life, like just trying to hide. Coming into this conversation, I was thinking, you know, what are the parallels between an anti-ageism movement versus an anti-ableism movement. And I think a lot of it is rooted in fear. And I think because I became disabled in, you know, when it wasn't a heroic story, I think that those origin stories, oftentimes we celebrate, you know, the people who have these really heroic stories of like becoming disabled as a result of being in combat. But I was just a kid who happened to be in a car accident. So in 2009, I looked back at my story and I realized that I was always framing myself as a victim. I was always framing that I had no control over what had happened to me. And I started to get really curious that because I wasn't talking about my disability origin story and no one was asking me about it, I wasn't really advocating for myself. And so in 2009, that kind of became the whole journey of exploring what does it look like for me to show up in the world feeling proud and courageous and brave in my narrative, like just showing up as myself. It's so liberating to be myself. And that's really how I think I came into being proud over my disability identity.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And to Ashton, you often start talks, I've noticed, with statistics to dispel myths around aging, like the number of people who are actually in nursing homes, and that, good golly, we're the happiest at the start and the end of our lives. And Alzheimer's incidence rates are dropping. Okay, what? Like, why do we think the opposite? And you know what? I'm going to ask you your disability story too.
Well, I've started to think about, am I disabled? I have one hearing aid and arthritis. Everything else seems to be working okay. But I do identify proudly as someone who is older and sometimes old. But we are very reluctant to identify as old, most of us. That's one reason I encourage the word older, and I even use it as a noun. I refer to olders and youngers because I think we have this horrifying idea, this binary of old, young, and then it's all going to be awful once we wake up some morning, you know, old and everything falls apart. I'm a nerdy person who comes at things by looking at facts. And I realized that in my mid-50s, this was almost 15 years ago, I was afraid of getting old. And I started researching. And the facts that I start my TED Talk out with, I learned 15 years ago. They are widely known. It became obvious that ageism was at the heart of them, but I just became obsessed with why so few people know these things. It's not that the scary stuff isn't true. I'm not a whitewasher of any sort. It's that our fears are so out of proportion to the reality. And it relates, unsurprisingly, to things that Tiffany was saying about disability. We live in a culture that frames aging as a problem, because if it's a problem, we could be persuaded to buy stuff to fix it, air quotes around the fix. And it is framed as a disease. As we age, our body becomes more vulnerable to things. Olders are more vulnerable to COVID, partly because of ageism, because of the way aging and older people are socially devalued, but our bodies are more vulnerable. Our immune systems are not as strong and our lungs are not as elastic. That's not bias, that's biology. But aging itself is not a disease. And so the natural transitions from wrinkles down to changing hormone levels are pathologized. Then the beauty industry, big pharma, plastic surgeons, you name it, can profit from our insecurities. In the social realm, all prejudice operates to pit us against each other, right? And if we can be alienated from our own older selves, that's internalized ageism, from people with disabilities because they remind us of scary things that might happen to us, then we are segregated from each other. We don't join forces and figure out how we can ally and learn from each other.
Yes. So a question sort of opening up to both of you as part of a conversation, because aging itself is based on the passage of time, for a person to be proud of being older and becoming older is dependent on the person continually adjusting to their aging over time. For an aging person to have age pride, and borrowing from queer pride, gay pride, and disability pride, they have to like come out as being proud of being older every time they adjust to their aging. Like that in itself is also inherent to the passing of time. So I feel like it could also possibly be true for persons who pass as younger, and I'm using pass in the same way as thinking about disabled people who are passing for non-disabled people and queer people passing as straight people, like in that way. Is there an equivalency there as far as pride and coming to terms as an ongoing process?
I'll step in here just briefly. First of all, I love this conversation because I feel like I'm learning a lot. Most of the organizations that I work with are nonprofits who are serving older adults. You know, it's not actually the older adults going out and advocating. What I think is interesting is that today my arm is paralyzed, and tomorrow my arm is paralyzed, and in 10 years from now, my arm will be paralyzed. I think to Sarah's point, I actually find that really interesting because I guess that if we associate things with your body and your health changing as you get older, that is adjustments that need to be made perhaps in terms of how you're viewing your own identity. Versus 20 years ago, this is how my arm was, but my arm is permanently disabled. So I want to make that distinction. For me, the narrative of get well soon is not a thing. And there's no further deterioration of my paralysis. I mean, of course, there's like muscle atrophy and stuff if I stop exercising, but that's a different thing.
I see a parallel between get well soon and stay young. I mean, ageism takes root in denial of the fact that we are aging. All prejudice gets its start in othering and seeing some group as other than ourselves. With ageism, the other is our own future older selves. You know, we're all ageist. We're all in a little bit of denial about stuff. For example, I lost my hearing because of a brain tumor, a benign brain tumor. But there was a moment where I thought, well, at least, you know, it's sexy brain tumor deafness, not sad sack old person deafness. Well, not so proud of that, but it, you know, it went through my head. What I urge people to do is just to try and get off this hamster wheel of age denial and acknowledge that we are aging. And the earlier in life you can do that, become what I call an old person in training, a phrase I appropriated from geriatrician Joanne Lynn, just acknowledge you're going to get old. And then we stop looking past or through older people and see things in them that we would like to emulate or would definitely not like to emulate. Not all old people are wise. Certainly many young people are wise. You know, those are stereotypes too. Most of us are reluctant to identify as older. There is a tremendous amount of passing for younger, you know, dyeing our hair to cover the gray, fudging our resumes, leaving off early accomplishments. Those behaviors are widely adopted, and I do not judge anyone for doing it because they are often necessary to hold on to our job or to feel like we're at play in our dating life or whatever. But when we do those things, we make ourselves invisible as older people. And when a group is invisible, so are the issues that affect it. And they give a pass to the discrimination that makes those behaviors necessary. Another really interesting comparison is that the longer we live, the more different from one another we become. Older people are the most diverse group ever, and people with disabilities are this incredibly heterogeneous group too. You might have someone who is born with a cognitive deficit, and you might have someone, you know, who is in an accident in their 30s. You have visible and invisible disabilities. There's something amazing and remarkable about how the diversity pride movement has brought this incredibly diverse group together, I'm sure with factions and all sorts of different identities. You know, it's not just a rainbow tent singing kumbaya, but nevertheless, there is an umbrella under which people have learned to identify and claim their identity. Aging is something we all do, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. And I just think we olders have so much to learn and to benefit by learning from that example. Maybe we won't make it all the way to pride and to embracing, but to accepting it and acknowledging it and seeing that we are who we are because we're the age we are, just as because we're the color we are, the gender we are, not despite it.
Absolutely. Embracing the new identity and not framing disability in fear. How can an anti-aging movement not frame disability in fear? As the idea of, well, we're all going to become disabled, so embrace it. But there is that of fear.
It's scary. It is genuinely scary. You know, there's no easy answer to that. It's to look honestly at it and to see that people age well, not by avoiding disability and increasing vulnerability, but despite it, by adapting to it. I mean, would you agree, Tiffany?
Yeah, I mean, I actually had someone write the word proud on my splint. And I remember, honestly, the first couple of times that I wore my splint, I felt like my splint was so loud. It was on my injured arm. It drew all the attention in. Everyone was asking me about it. And then I was like, you know what? I feel like I got this splint aspirationally because I want to be proud. Now that I've worn the splint for a pretty significant amount of time and people are like, oh, what happened to your hand? I'm like, oh, here, look at my hand. Let me tell you the story of my splint. Let me tell you and honor part of my body that has taken me on these incredible adventures. I do think that the language is really important. All of us will have some version of internalized ableism or internalized ageism. There was definitely a period of time where I was still shaking people's hands with my injured hand because why would there be a left-handed handshaker? Now I'm a left-handed handshaker and I am very unapologetic about that. But it is kind of this journey around, at least in my case, how am I talking about my disability? Am I framing it like it's a sad thing, like, oh, I'm getting older, or like, oh, I have muscle atrophy? Or am I framing it in a way that is really more celebratory? And Sarah, two anecdotal things. One is I will often see media say, this person did this exceptional thing despite their disability. And I think that when we use language like despite, or like even if you insert age in there, like I don't want to be despite some part of my identity. I want the incredible thing that I just did to happen because of all of my identities, because I am who I am. And then wouldn't it be cool if we got buns that just said like, I'm old? I don't know. And I know we have some equivalent of that within the disability community where we have like Crip Pride and other stuff like that. The second thing I'll say is that we don't want to talk about identities at the expense of each other. So sometimes I have heard people say that aging is not a disability. But what if someone holds both of those identities, right? when I hear it framed in that way, then it makes me think that disability is a bad word. Aging is not a bad word. Older is not a bad word. Disability is not a bad word. How can we approach these things where we have a neutral baseline, but positive leaning?
It's complicated, as always, because there is a whole strain of people, a whole school of thought, I should say, which is sort of positive aging or even successful aging, that to age well means really typically spending a lot of money and working really hard to look and act like younger versions of ourselves, which I think those people would say is being positive about it. To my mind, that is papering over fears. That's like when you're a kid and you think there's a monster under the bed and you just make a running leap for your bed, which I did when I was 7, rather than look and see. And there are monsters. I mean, the loss of physical function is scary. The loss of cognitive function, it is a dark and human fear. But when we pretend these are not happening and seeing the self erode when that happens to us, rather than the self become very often enriched, people whose lives are very constrained by physical immobility, for example, can be the most fascinating people in the world. We are the sum of all of our experiences. And simply by having contact, I think, with people of all ages and with people who are living with disability, which has a huge overlap with older people, we pretend as it is that the overlap doesn't exist. I mean, I'm always pointing out to 40-year-olds, dude, you already can't run as fast as you used to or have sex for as long as you used to. You're still running, you're still having sex, you're still doing fine. I think we could work together on breaking down this idea that that's from before and after, some good state and bad state. We are constantly adapting. It's only zero sum if people with disabilities never grow old and older people never become disabled. And if you put it that way, you see like both of those sound good, but they're terrible. I mean, it's like a paradox. And that's what we need to wrestle with. That's why it's so interesting.
That kind of would lead me into a question around the sort of big distinction between an age pride movement and disability pride movement is to age and continue to be an aging person is in itself a privilege. How then can those equivalencies be made? Or do they even need to be? Yeah, do they even need to be? Before it slips my mind, Tiffany, at Home with Growing Older, we do actually have these stickers that say, ask me my age.
San Francisco has a fantastic anti-ageism campaign with these great buttons.
The Community Living Campaign, who I believe is one of the co-creators or one of the creators of that campaign, has gotten these buttons that says like, wisdom never gets old, creativity never gets old.
And in different languages.
And the Community Living Campaign, if people aren't aware, they have services and programs for people with disabilities and older adults.
In general, municipalities that have combined aging and disability populations being served as a city agency, if you think that has a positive influence or a negative influence or no influence at all on bridging these movements together. And I'm thinking of the End Ageism campaign, but Tiffany, you pointed out there was no End Ableism campaign.
What I think is interesting is we have a lot of these agencies, we have a lot of these organizations that serve older adults and people with disabilities, but never cross. And I don't want to use never because it could change. I don't want to use that permanent language. But I think what's interesting is that our city department is called the Department of Disability and Aging Services. So the disability services part of that is 18 plus. But if I just see disability and aging services paired together as someone who is in my 30s, I don't think that that's for me. And I've actually never gone to that department for seeking services. So that was actually something that we talked to that department about saying, hey, anytime you mention that you serve adults with disabilities, can you include 18 plus? They're always paired together, but then the initiatives are separate. So, I mean, we have this End Ageism campaign. If you want to learn more about that campaign, go to endageism.com. In one of our meetings where they were talking about the campaign, someone asked, are we going to have an End Ableism campaign? And I'm not quite sure what the answer was for that, but I have heard that it is quite expensive because they put up flags around the city and they were on buses. I mean, I thought it was really well done and it was very visible.
I met with Shireen McFadden, who started it when I was in San Francisco over a year ago, and I was so impressed by the people at the meeting, not least because several people were disabled, which I thought was fantastic. And she mentioned the change of name to include the incorporation of aging and disabilities. And the comment I remember her making was that they reached new people, people in the disability community, once it was enlarged. You know, it depends. The bigger the tent, the greater the potential for collaboration and for people meeting up across these perceived divisions and discovering joint issues. But everyone has to have a voice. I think very highly of the people who are running that campaign. And I think just getting people in the same room is a huge step. You know, if we ignore the overlap between disability and age, and I think it's pretty strong in the aging community because people are reluctant, which I totally understand, to equate aging and disability. There's the whole huge model of aging as deficit, poor, sad, old people who need taking care of. So I'll say for the 15th time in just this hour, it's complicated, but we need to acknowledge at the same time that these changes do occur, and to pretend that they don't occur doesn't do any of us any favors. And it keeps these communities apart and it alienates us from our future selves. And when our strategies to prevent oldness from happening fall, we fall fast and hard.
Yeah. And I just wanted to add, when I sit in these groups, I often find that the conversation is very much geared to older adults. I do feel a little bit of erasure of my experience as a younger working age disabled person, because I find that most disability services are geared toward parents who have kids, and then you have older adult and disability groups, right? And so honestly, part of the reason why I started Diversability was that I noticed we didn't really have this group of like 20 to 50-ish age people who were just going about their daily lives and proud of their disability identities. Disabled kids become disabled adults. Yep. In that prime working age. And then we have the later in life onset disability, older adults. I've spoken at City Hall about this. Oftentimes we'll invite people to come and speak about their services, and I'll always make a comment about how the needs of me as a 30-something year old disabled person are different from a 60-year-old disabled person. And how can we make sure we're catering services to all of these different communities?
Absolutely.
You are listening to At Home On Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
So one question was from Amy. How can anti-ageist movements be more inclusive rather than starting conversations but distancing ourselves from people living in nursing homes and people with cognitive impairment? Anti-ageism in her mind sort of stops when you go into nursing homes and have dementia. How can this be more inclusive?
From my perspective, I'd love to see more people like Ashton, because most of when I hear about anti-ageism movements, they're led by organizations who maybe don't have people who have the lived experience. And then anytime I hear about services and stuff, they're always geared toward kind of like the extreme bottom of the barrel scenarios. And if you don't follow Ashton on social media, like I think the way that she frames things, it's done in a playful way. The last video I saw was around adding captions and the fact that you have a hearing aid, and now we're all going to wear masks, so please caption your videos. How can we be more fun and more playful rather than always this disempowering narrative? I mean, this is how I think about disability too, because like I have artwork on my splint. It's not a medical thing. It's part of my personality. It's part of my brand.
I mean, I can only answer that question as an older person. I think it's important to look around and make sure we do also talk about people living with dementia, that we use we language. One of my bugaboos is even like really interesting progressive people in old land, as I call it very professionally, who are writing about ageism and about ageism in the lens of COVID, who are my age or older, are still talking about older people as they. Which shows that they still have some work to do. They're still like distancing themselves from those sad, needy older people in some way. I think it's incumbent on we olders to use inclusive language and to make sure the conversation involves not just the amazing older people who are exceptionally active and out there in the world and doing things that are typically associated with younger people, but that we embrace people at the other end of the spectrum too. And if people with disabilities can do that across this enormous range of conditions and circumstances, we can do it across age, because age is the universal. We can't know what it's like to have, you know, cerebral palsy if you don't have it, or to be blind, but we all know what it's like to get older.
It's a universal experience, yes. One question from Erin. How do you feel about the phrase, age is just a number?
I can't stand it. Like so many things. I mean, because age is a very real number. It is the number of times you have circled the sun. And to pretend that we can wish it away or talk about agelessness reinforces denial. It's complicated because when someone wants that number, I think it's also important to say how old you are, for example. But why do you want to know? We attach a fixed meaning to it, and that needs to be questioned. And especially since the longer we live, the less our chronological age says about what we're capable of physically, mentally, or cognitively. But it's not just a number that we can wish away. It's not just an attitude, right? It is a very real number that is part of how we anchor ourselves to our individual and collective experience.
And then maybe a related question from Rachel. Ashton, do I remember correctly that you don't share your exact age?
I'm 67. That was a troll you heard that from. Now, I will very soon be 68. If I started lying about my age, I would never have remembered it. You know, I do think it's important to say how old you are, but I think it's really important to push back on why I'd like to see age taken out of newspaper stories, unless it's an obituary or a child prodigy. Often, age has nothing to do with the story, which is why it's always double-edged.
The question from Paul. In 1992 or so, ASA held a conference to bring leaders in aging and disability together. Also, the HIV/AIDS community in the 90s was very involved in changing nursing homes. There hasn't been enough collaboration between the groups. Any ideas on how to combine the efforts beyond New York and San Francisco?
Paul Klayman runs a fantastic newsletter called Generations Beat Online and really, really knows policy and history way better than I do. I think we need to learn from each other about how movements start and how coalitions form. I'm going about it this way because it was the best idea I had.
And I just want to add two things I've been thinking about. One is, and I pose this question within diversibility, what does disability wellness look like? What does age wellness look like? And I think that for a really long time, I thought that being well and being disabled were mutually exclusive. And now what I'm learning is that my physical wellness isn't just my arm, right? It isn't just the physical manifestation of my disability. And so as I'm hearing all of you speak, it's getting me thinking about age wellness and how can we share more of those stories. And then the second thing I'll add is, so Rosemary Garland Thompson, who is the person that I mentioned at the beginning, a professor at Emory, she is older. I think this is where intersectionality really comes into play. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with intersectionality, it's when you hold multiple oppressed identities. So for me, that could be being disabled. It could be being a person of color. It could be looking young. It could be, did I mention being a woman? So the last time Rosemary and I chatted, we were thinking about starting an intergenerational disability advocates group. What she said to me, and she's been a wonderful mentor, she said, Tiffany, I have been your age, but you have never been my age. But what I think is interesting is she approaches her work disability first. She happens to be an older person. She happens to be a woman. She happens to hold these other identities. And the hard thing about intersectionality, at least what I'm feeling now, is that now with the increase in hate crimes against Asians because they think we're carriers of coronavirus, plus the discriminatory triage practices that may be happening at hospitals, plus group homes for people who have disabilities and not being able to socially distance, I feel like my brain is exploding. Like I can't handle having so many of those oppressed identities be at the forefront all the time, which is potentially why we haven't really seen a cross-ageism, cross-ableism, anti to both of those movement. I mean, if you meet anyone, let me know. But I have yet to meet someone who is both like an Ashton and a Tiffany. And the thing is, whenever I show up at a space, it's almost like, this is really exhausting that I'm showing up in my disability-centered identity, or today I'm going to show up in this space in my Asian-centered identity. It's almost like I have to pick which depressed identity shows up first.
The thing that put this bug in my ear to start with was the framing of COVID as, don't worry about it, it's only going to kill old people and sick people. The thought experiment I've been putting out there is, think what the response would look like now everywhere in the world if we had known from the beginning that healthy younger people would also fall to the disease. It would look really different. We are seeing the global lethal cost of ageism and ableism compounded. And I feel that this is an extraordinary opportunity to finally acknowledge this intersection and build upon it. What that's going to look like is, Tiffany just put it so eloquently, you know, what are each of our identities and each of our aptitudes and each of our appetites? Bring whatever piece of this massive pie with so many components to it, whatever piece of it you stand on, bring that into the room and start talking about it.
Jessica said, thank you so much, Tiffany and Ashton and all. In terms of older people distancing themselves from nursing home residents, how do our movements work together better to get people out of facilities and create better home care options? I see assumptions in the senior community about people who need to be in institutions, while the disability rights movement claims that anyone can live at home with the right supports. I think that's a really important point.
It's a really important point. I am not an expert. You know, it's an incredibly complicated field. I can tell you that there are wonderful people who go into nursing homes. These are family businesses. People love this business, and it is really important. And it is taking a beating now for some very legitimate reasons. But only 2.5% of the 65 plus population is in nursing homes. Nursing homes provide skilled nursing care, and some people need skilled nursing care. So I don't think it's ever going to go away. I'm dead center of the baby boom. My generation does not want to end up in some yucky, you know, linoleum hallway if we can avoid it. And all kinds of options are emerging. Housing options, building options, intergenerational options, community-based options. So I would look up organizations that are working on that, because I can tell you a lot of people are at work on them.
I certainly think that the Aging Pride movements can look at the history of the independent living movement, which got us to where we are today in disability rights, bringing people out of institutions and nursing homes where they didn't need to be in the first place.
People living with dementia not being shut away and living in the community. A lot of really interesting progressive work being done there.
Yeah.
Going into a somewhat different direction from Erin, how do you feel about media presenting, quote unquote, exceptional older adults? Would it be a good or bad thing to have a top 60 over 60 list?
One of the things I learned about when researching my book was about the disability community, and please correct me if I get anything wrong, Tiffany, talking about inspiration porn, you know, the crippled kid skiing or the crippled kids kissing. Not something extraordinary, just a regular thing that people do.
Super Crips.
Super Crips. And I coined the term super geezer, which is the 90-year-old who climbs Everest, the octogenarians who jump out of airplanes for some reason I don't understand. You know, they are remarkable people. They are inspirational to lots of people, but they are pretty much exemplars of this sort of successful aging idea. And I think it's really important to frame them as outliers. They are not most of us. There's no problem with most of us not aspiring to that. And most of us cannot afford to do those things, even if we did aspire to them. Huge class bias here. So they're fine, but I'm more interested in the rest of us in the messy middle, which of course, by definition, is where most of us will end up muddling our way without being extraordinary and feeling that we are failing in any way if we cannot or do not aspire to be like them.
One comment which sort of fits to this from Rachel, which says, age wellness in the media looks like old people who look young, but my true models of well, in quotes, adults actually didn't look young, or at least that's not what I noticed or admired about them.
I couldn't agree more. Wrinkles are beautiful.
And then from Marie from the Community Living Campaign, a suggestion for collaboration. One place we should all come together here in California is that the governor is proposing to eliminate the adult day health center funding. That is a way that people can get higher levels of services and still live at home with their families. So that relates to, you know, independent living, et cetera.
I would love to see senior centers be community centers and not be ghettos for older people, but be places where all ages could come together. You know, aging in place, like everything, it's double-edged. If you're aging in community, that's great. People are understandably reluctant to leave the homes they've always lived in, where they raise their kids, et cetera, but there's a lot of denial going on. We need to make sure that options for staying at home really are places that have social services, social support, community support, public transportation, and not valorize this idea. I mean, I would like to take the whole word independent out of everywhere, because everyone needs help all the time, our whole lives long. You don't become suddenly dependent any more than you become suddenly immobile or suddenly demented. You might become suddenly disabled. I mean, that's another interesting comparison. There's so many discussions we could talk about. But how do we prepare? It all has to do with not being in denial and starting conversations early and making sure that there will be supports that we need by the time we need them.
Yeah, and I'm just going to add two things in here. And one is our original tagline when we started Diversibility was we wanted to rebrand disability, however you want to interpret that. I think that aging needs a rebranding too. One of the projects that Jessica and I got to work on was helping to envision what a disability cultural and community center was going to look like in San Francisco. And my dream for that was I want to walk into that disability cultural center like I'm walking into a WeWork. I want lots of natural light coming in. I want open space, wooden accents. How can we turn these, I think, Ashton, you called them ghettos, but it's like when I walk into a nursing home, am I walking into a hospital? Or am I walking into some cool modern thing that makes me excited to be there?
Yeah, no Formica.
Talking about a disability center, I don't know if you guys know the Ed Roberts campus in Berkeley, which is a fantastic example of what you just talked about, Tiffany. It looks like a version of the Guggenheim with an amazing, beautiful ramp centered in the middle of the lobby. This is a perfect example how this should look. And what I also want to briefly say from an architect's perspective, you know, I was very fortunate to work on a senior community center in Palo Alto, the Avenida Center, and we did a post-occupancy study there asking people after the building was finished how they liked the building and certain features of the building. I have to say that there were a lot of people who wanted to be acknowledged as being old or older, and they did not appreciate sort of that the center was more directed towards quote unquote younger, older adult, which is sort of a trend in the senior community center field. So I think that's a really important and complex issue that people do want to be recognized as old and do want to get special treatment, and how to reflect this not only in an architecture that is inclusive and integrated and beautiful, but also in the programming is a real challenge, I think.
Tiffany and Ashton, this is amazing. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm high-fiving you. I'm shaking your hands. Thank you, thank you.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.